Before we begin, we'd like to ask a favor. If you could take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we'd really appreciate it. We're told it helps the show find new listeners. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the B&B podcast, a project from Brick Lane Bookshop. This is our 18th episode and our first for a while, so thank you for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite writers to read from their work and discuss the short story form, their writing process, their route to publication, and what they're reading. I'm Kate Ellis, a former Brick Lane bookseller and founder of the Short Story Prize. I'm afraid we're missing my co-host Peter J. Coles today, but he will be behind the scenes editing my solo effort. Today, we are very happy to be speaking with Kay Lockwood Jefford, who won the 2023 Brick Lane Bookshop Short Story Prize with her story Kissing in Berlin. Kay Lockwood Jefford is a Welsh writer and former NHS psychiatrist. Her work appears in Prospect magazine, MIR Online, and many Short Story Prize anthologies, including The Bristol, Fish, Rhys Davies, and Aesthetica. Awards include the V.S. Pritchett Prize, Bath Short Story Award, and third prize in the Brick Lane Short Story Prize 2020. She recently completed her first collection of short fiction. So we are in the Brick Lane office above the bookshop today, and I am lucky to be joined by Kay Lockwood Jefford, who was the winner of the 2023 Brick Lane Bookshop Short Story Prize. Hello, Kate. Welcome.
Hello.
Nice to have you.
Lovely to be here.
So, as ever, we're going to begin the podcast with a reading, and Kate is going to read from her prize-winning story, Kissing in Berlin. Are you ready to go?
Yeah. London, 6th of July, 2000. A burlesque night in a Soho club in the mishmash of streets west of Wardour. Banquettes in balding burgundy velvet. A bar in vinyl and wood veneer. Nipple tassels, feather boas, and fishnet tight legs on the tiny, plinth-like stage. Celesta, an ex-medical student, is waiting tables, all slim, agile, and swift in ballet pumps and black second-hand slacks. Hetty, an associate professor of horticulture at a Russell Group university, sits alone in her favourite Vivian Westwood, sipping Brandy Alexander's. Recently split from her girlfriend of 5 years, they never last longer. She likes the look of the cocktail waitress. And Celesta admires the woman in expensive-looking clothes drinking creamy cocktails, imagines skimming the tip of her tongue along the rim of white foam on her top perfectly lipsticked lip. For Celesta, their first kiss in a black cab racing to Hetty's garden, flat in Primrose Hill. Tastes of Parma violets. When she moves in with Hetty, Celesta finds an unfamiliar top hanging in her allocated not quite half of the wardrobe, a floaty style she'd never wear, a brand she'd never buy even if she could afford it. It must be yours, Hetty says. Who else could it belong to? Celesta says no more. She just buries it, quietly, in the garden. July the 6th, 2005, London. Celesta and Hetty are having drinks on the terrace of a bar in Belsize Park, celebrating Hetty's promotion to a full professorship. She's been invited to give a keynote address at a European symposium on plant blindness in Berlin. The bar is buzzing. The early evening news announced that London had won the bid for the 2012 Olympics. Hetty's already excited that this may mean funding opportunities for her East London-based department. Celesta doesn't mention it's also their 5th anniversary. She knows Hetty has forgotten. Next morning, Celesta wakes in the waves of warmth coming off the slumbering mass of Hetty, like her own private microclimate. She switches to her side to admire the heft of Hetty, the undulating landscape of her rolling folds of flesh, the creases and crevices hers to explore. Only Celesta knows that every cubic centimetre of Hetty is required to house her sheer intellectual brilliance, propel the force of her personality. Celesta drinks her coffee on the south-facing terrace, admiring the hydrangea, a Mexican wave from pink to lilac to purple to blue, like so many heads of big hair jostling for prominence. Celesta could spend all day planting, pruning, weeding, watering, watching things grow. Hetty says it's what she pays the gardener for. As soon as she arrives at work, Celesta knows something is wrong. People are standing at their desks, looking at each other, not speaking. Her first thought is someone's died. A celebrity? The Queen? But it isn't that. Bombs going off on the tube, someone says. No one knows anything for sure. King's Cross is mentioned, and Celesta's stomach flips and dives. Hetty takes the tube via King's Cross. She lunges for the nearest desk phone to call Hetty's PA, who answers straight away. She's just come through the door, he says. And in that brief, most fleeting of moments, just before relief flows in, Celesta feels an undertow of disappointment.
Thank you very much. The fact that she feels disappointment says so much in such little space. I love that line. So that won last year's short story competition. I wondered if you would mind talking about the experience of winning the competition. How did it feel? Ooh. Was it important?
It is extremely important. And I think, I mean, in the way that you kind of relive moments afterwards, some sort of, I mean, I remember saying what I normally say before I knew that I'd won, when I was just introducing my reading, the same reading that I've just done. And I remember saying something about it being my favourite short story prize, which is not a lie. And people laughing as if this meant I was kind of, you know, cozying up to the judges, which of course I wasn't. But I was just mortified that people would think that. And then I sort of something struck me. I thought I could get the order that we were going in, and I kept getting my story ready to read. And you kept not looking at me, looking at somebody else. And then I thought something's up. And I began to wonder, and then, oh, it was just such a wonderful, wonderful surprise. I was convinced that I wouldn't win a prize. I felt very, very lucky, and you know, I thought it was fantastic that I was in the book. You know, that I made the long list, and the fact that I'd won third prize a couple of years ago meant to me that there was no way I was going to win the prize. Although I know rationally that doesn't necessarily make sense. But no, and I had most of the people from the two writing workshops I'm in were here. You know, there was a really, really nice, warm crowd. You know, friends were here. It was just really, really nice. And I just feel really proud and chuffed to say, you know, winning first prize in Brick Lane Bookshop. So, but I think the event, I've sort of said this before, I think it's a tiny little book. A tiny little bookshop, and it's a lovely, lovely space, but it just really felt really cosy and friendly. And
it was a really lovely night, actually.
Yes, and I mean, it was awful outside.
It was another stormy today, and it was another stormy night. And obviously, I knew that you'd won, so, and you kept asking me, oh, can I invite this person and this person? And I was like, yes, she's got a fan club, this is perfect. Obviously, you had no idea that they would all be cheering your win.
No, so and it was partly because I knew all the people that were going to be there that made me extra, I mean, I was determined to come, of course I was, but we were coming up from Folkestone, from the coast, and actually, it took us the best part of 2.5 hours to get here, which is over twice.
Yeah,
and we took the slow train, and we got here on time, but it felt very just. Mm. So that was all a good omen, really.
It was, yeah. It was a lovely night. And you did mention that you were in the anthology in 2020. I had no idea that you were the same writer. The stories are very, very different. But only once I knew it was you, I could recognise elements of the style.
Yeah.
What made you enter again?
So it's interesting you say that about them being different, because I think of them as different, but also because they're both mine.
Mm.
And they're both going to be in, well, they both are in this anthology that I've been working on, that aside. I can't remember what you said. What was the question?
What did I say? I think you kind of answered it actually in a previous question. I asked you why you want to enter the prize again.
I like the prize, and also rightly or wrongly, I've just got into this habit of short story competitions and the boundaries that they provide and the deadlines, if you like,
mm-hmm.
and the opportunity that there may be a publication, you may get to meet people. It's kind of just been a thing that I've used in my writing, perhaps more so than submitting to magazines, which I should do more of. I mean, there's no reason why you can't do both, but I've sort of, maybe there's something about how with the short story competition, all you have to do is put your thing in and other people do the rest of the work. I don't know.
But. Yeah, in a magazine you might have to communicate with the editor or write a cover letter. Whereas
yes.
This can be, you know, it's an entry form.
Yes.
It's kind of...
Yeah, so maybe it's a bit lazy. I don't know.
No, I don't think it's lazy. It's just whatever drives you on.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're about to open submissions for the competition this year. I wondered if you had any advice or wisdom that you might give to people that are going to enter this year.
I will say something, but I think advice, I can only, well, I'm sure this is kind of obvious, really, people will take it in this spirit, that I can only say what I think, and it may not make any sense to, you know, other writers. But I think the thing about the Brick Lane short story competition, perhaps compared to some others, is that it does give you quite a lot of space. You know, you've got up to 5,000 words. And a lot of the stories I write are much sort of shorter. So, and then some are a bit longer and don't sort of fit with the remit of a lot of competitions. So you have got that scope. And I suppose apart from that, I would say enter, get it done, enter, use the deadline. It is a really, really good competition. I think the people are really good. I think it very much is about, as it says at the front of the anthology, it's committed to opening doors and making opportunities for people. So it is a good competition from that point of view. I think in terms of what you write, then that's kind of much more about how you write short stories, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think...
I've asked you an impossible question.
Well, really. I just think that people need to write what they want to write.
Yeah.
And write it as well as they can. And, you know, submit it.
Mm.
Submit it. Don't try... I suppose that's the thing. Don't try to do something that you think will win the Brick Lane Bookshop, but, you know, because... I don't know. I've heard writer sort of friends or associates saying that they've entered the fish, therefore they've set a story in Ireland, or that you know. And I just
right.
think you don't. I think if you've got a story, fine. But I think if it feels a bit artificial,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure people realise that. But yeah, do your best.
Yeah.
Put it in.
Yeah, I think write what you want to write is good advice, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. How you want to write it as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 I'm going to move on to talking about your story mm-hmm. now. And I'm going to embarrass you slightly by saying the judges loved it, obviously. And they described it as being rich in detail and sensuality, completely compelling, and as a fraught love story. I wondered if you could describe it in your own words.
Oh, God. I mean, that's very nice to hear. Well, it's hard. I suppose I was sort of thinking about what is it about. I sort of find it hard to. I think it's Cullen Jones, the writer that I've done a couple of workshops with, sort of talks aboutness.
Mm-hmm.
There's like what the story's about, which might be something a bit more like a plot. You know, two women in a relationship go to a conference in Berlin on the day after. There has been a bomb on the London Tube, and the reader knows that there are, you know, some difficulties in the relationship which aren't really being communicated about. So I suppose that would be one. And then I suppose there's the aboutness, which might be more kind of themes which aren't necessarily bedded down in the script. And I suppose for me there's something about, you know, attachment and intimacy and the things we do to try and... sort of maintain a relationship that's good and the things that we will do just to stay in a relationship that's maybe not so good, and how do we know anyway? And I think this is something that the character talks about. And I suppose I was sort of struck by the notion of, I mean, it wasn't deliberate. Sometimes I see the metaphors after I've written them because I haven't been thinking, oh, right, I'm going to do... Mm-hmm. The bomb, it happened to be that timing, because when I was writing the story, I had in mind a time I'd been to Berlin, which did happen to be in the week after the London bombing. So that was sort of in my mind in terms of how people, a lot of people asked us about it. And but I suppose there's also the you know, the kind of emotional, you know, when something very dramatic happens and you feel, you know, you've been sort of hit by something, not to be sort of too glib about it. And I was really struck, actually, by the way that I think it's Gernike in the comments, one of the judges, and I hadn't thought about this either, you know, that there's a butler, that a button is quite significant in the story, and buttons are about attachments as well. True, and I hadn't thought that, but I wondered if, because the story actually started with the button. And obviously it's about Berlin. I mean, Berlin is a place that I don't know well. I haven't lived there, like, you know, I think you have, haven't you?
Briefly, yeah.
Yeah. Great. It is a great city. I mean, there are many great European cities, and I think it's definitely one of them. So I think it's also kind of celebrating Berlin. It's probably about as much as I've ever seen in, mm-hmm. in Berlin is in the story. But I don't know if that's kind of wandering off. Also, the theme of greening our cities... It that wasn't something that was in part of the kind of original draft, but that emerged from trying to think what specialty Hetty was a professor in, and then I was just thinking, well, what might her lecture be on? And anyway, that it sort of grew from just research around mm-hmm. that. And I mean, I love some of the reading that you do around stories that you weren't planning to, but you end up being a mini expert for mm-hmm. as long as you can, you know, as long as you remember it, about areas that completely alien to you. So, but I thought somehow again there was a parallel in whether the relationship is nurturing nurturing or neglectful, and mm-hmm. what, because it's really, as told through the one character, Celeste's point of view, it's you don't really know what is, we only see what Hetty does, we mm-hmm. we don't know what she's thinking, so that's very open to the read, you know, down to the reader's decision, I suppose, or understanding. But she, it's like, how much will she put up with, I suppose, is partly what mm-hmm. the story's about. And yeah. I suppose I was going to say we've all been there. Well, certainly I have, in relationships. So I suppose, although it's got a particular, it looks a particular way from the outside, I think on the inside the feelings are ones that I imagine a lot of people are sort of familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was... both characters were relatable in a way, and one of the things I liked about the story was how frank they were about how tricky it is to understand where you stand in a relationship. Mm. I think at one point Celeste is like, you know, how is it supposed to feel
yeah.
in a relationship?
Yeah,
and that was sort of, yeah, they were very human.
And the other thing I'm just sort of reminded of, actually, with Celeste, is that I've made her adopted, if that's not a ridiculous awkward sentence, but she's adopted. Now, there's not much made of that in the story, but to me it's another, for me, my understanding of the character is it's a theme. And I know a few people, as a lot of people will, I suppose, who've been adopted, and it is, I've been very struck at how it's still, they still kind of wear that in some mm-hmm. shape or form today, you know, and in their relationships, and they bring a particular, we all bring different vulnerabilities, and there's not, everybody who's been adopted has got different experiences mm-hmm. of that, so it's not one thing, but that for me was something I wanted to bring in as well.
The B&B podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, we're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount off any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org.
It's about a relationship, but I found the choice of structure very interesting, because it fit. We begin at the beginning of the relationship, and then we jump 5 years, and we're kind of thrown into what is basically the end of the relationship.
Yeah.
And so you kind of miss the middle. You miss them falling for each other. You miss them, you know, beginning to, the cracks are beginning to show. And it's really effective. I wondered why you chose to remove the middle like that.
Well, the short answer to that is, I don't know. It was sort of what happened. And the story actually started, and maybe this will go some way to sort of answering it, but the story started in an online workshop I did. I mean, I started it in the middle of 2020, so it was about 3 years, actually two to three years. Anyway, that's how long stories normally take for me, but kind of, you know, coming to them, coming again, going away. And I really did struggle with it, perhaps a bit more than might be normal. I don't know. But it started with the button, and from that grew the characters, and it was going to be based in Berlin. It was going to be a conference, and it was going to be when the relationship goes wrong. And the earlier drafts just made you very much arrived. You were with them in Berlin from the start. It began with them in bed and Celeste waking up, and and then there was more of a sort of referring back. There was a fleeting reference to how they met, but it wasn't a scene. And then it was one of the things that just wasn't really, that the whole story wasn't really working. It needed quite a lot of shaking up and sort of putting together again. I'd forgotten this, but I was thinking about it on the train coming up here, and this would have been in the sort of last sort of months of trying to work on it, when it sort of felt I had a bit of a sort of sudden eureka moment, when I just knew what might work, and it sort of did. But I don't know if you've heard of a 1970s film called Celine and Julie Go Boating. Okay. And I've never seen it, but it was a title that always fascinated me, and I must see the film now, and I'd actually forgotten. But as I was going through the notes and just thinking for the story and the draft and thinking this is a mess, I suddenly thought the title of the film came to mind. Maybe it's because of Celeste, Celine, they're not a million miles away. And I looked up the film and I came across a summary of the plot. And there was something about the scenes that it starts with, and it's like, you know, young woman on park bench, another woman. And that was how the first scene started. I thought, actually, I'm just going to write that scene where they meet, which hadn't been in there before. And then also we'll kind of hear about the 5 year thing, because it had to be 2005, because I decided there was going to be the London bomb, and that would be important. I mean, I was in London, I'm sure you were too, perhaps, for the, I had this fantasy that some people might actually be disappointed.
In
relationships that are ambivalent, you know, because, you know, whether they know they're ambivalent or not. But so that was kind of what I knew. It had to be 2005. Therefore, a bit randomly, I decided to make the relationship about 5 years long, and maybe not that solid a relationship. But
you are a trained psychotherapist, says your bio. I wondered if you could talk a little about how that kind of thinking and work allows you to build characters or sort of get into the depths of them.
A good question. I trained in psychodynamic model, for want of a better word, and I mean, just very, very broadly speaking, it's about kind of trying to help people understand their behaviour that they may want to change, to understand where it comes from, and it takes into account feelings or things that may be unconscious, you know, whether that's related to memory or actual experience or fantasy, blah, blah. But it's the way it made sense to me. I didn't train as a cognitive behaviour therapist, which is another big mm-hmm. model. I mean, they're not the only two, but... Mm-hmm. And my colleague was a cognitive behaviour therapist. We got on very well. But she said, you know, like it makes, that's how she thinks about the world. So maybe she did CBT because mm-hmm. that was, it made sense to her. And I think I did the, so I'm not sure where I would be able to draw a line between, I mean, I've learned a lot in my training, hopefully. But I think I probably thought about people a bit like that anyway. So I don't quite know about that. But it struck me because I write, it struck me that I always write the first draft longhand, and that's just how I'm built. I can't go straight into typing it. That sort of comes later. But I use these A4 exercise books that I actually used during my training because they used to be sort of issued to us. And so if you like, what used to contain sort of, you know, case notes now contains my fiction. I mean, I did actually order some more, so I'm not. but I became attached to these books, I think. I mean, they're very useful. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they're much better than the A5 size. But I do remember somebody saying, and they didn't, I don't think they knew about my background in a very, very early workshop, sort of, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, that that the characters, it read like their case notes. And I thought, that's not good, you know.
But I think one of the words that I use to describe it is quite forensic, the way you write about people. You kind of, you use short sentences, and the prose is very economical. And so it kind of makes sense that they kind of are like case studies, but in a good way, because you, as a reader, it takes very few words for you to understand the depth of a character.
Yeah, I mean, I just have a lot. I did a lot of. I don't practice. I don't work in that now. I sort of made a decision that it's. I just, even if you're working one day a week, which at one point I was, you think about patients all the time.
Yeah.
So I just thought, I can't. You know, I need to sort of make some space, and you know, mm-hmm. lucky enough to be able to do that. But I think I have an understanding that, you know, we are. This is just my understanding. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not going to, you know, make any great theoretical. But it works for me to understand that we are how we are now has a relationship to how we were then and what our early experiences were. Mm-hmm. And but then it can start to sound a little bit like I'm teaching, or but I suppose I think people, they behave and they act what they can't say.
Yeah.
And I think that's always been the best I can sort of do. So I think sometimes I try to show how people are behaving rather than sort of analysing it. But mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a bit of both sometimes.
You've referred a few times to how you practice your writing. You write longhand and you have writing groups. I wondered if, and stories can take 2 or 3 years. Mm. Would you mind describing your editing process? Do you have a sort of format, or is it sort of story by story situation?
I imagine that there, I would say it's story by story, but I would imagine that there are, there's a crossover, because I think I probably do each one the same, even if the material is going to be sort of different or the challenges are going to be different. I remember hearing somebody else say that they do a lot of free writing, and I suppose not so much at the moment, but I would start off with a lot of material. And if I've got an idea for a story which could come from anywhere, then I'll just write loads. And then I have the image of kind of hacking back either a sort of really thorny, brambly bush, and then eventually it becomes like a sort of lump of, I don't know, really kind of lumpy kind of, I don't know, is pastry the right? I have a sense of then you know, working something or needing something, as in K-N-E-A-D-ding. Something that I'm trying to kind of get out, mm-hmm. to get it out. And then it's like, oh, now you can brush it off and there it is. You know,
so it's sort of like sculpting for you.
Yeah, so it sort of starts whittling. Off, yeah, like kind of weeding and hacking, mm-hmm. like my mother in the garden. And then it's, and then it becomes something a bit more finesse. But that can take a long time. And I do really, there's something about the story being ready for the first time to take it to a workshop. But I'm aware, compared to other people in my workshop, I never know what to call people in my workshop. They're my friends, they're writers, they're my, you know, but my workshop people, I'll take it. I think I'll take things to the workshop sooner than other people might. I think I get the impression, although I wouldn't want to sort of, you know, embarrass people by kind of, you know, but I get the impression that some people they wait a bit longer before they take it. Whereas I kind of don't care so much if it's a bit rubbish and they, because they're not going to say it like that. They're going to say something in a constructive way. And we know each other well enough now. I mean, they're both groups of people that I met at Birkbeck. So, you know, we go back a long time. And I don't necessarily take everything that is said, but I think if something really chimes, and especially if it's something I've thought of and ignored and thought, it doesn't matter. So I think I use people's comments as steers for editing. Or sometimes people will say, oh, this makes me think about blah, and I'll go and read blah, which might feed into editing. Yeah. But it's basically about cutting. And then I remember reading somewhere, and actually quite ruthlessly, because I am very much a kind of hold on to your darlings, and I think I have a thing now where it'll be used again. And even if it isn't, it doesn't matter. You think it's going to be used again, so therefore you can take it out. But I think I remember reading, and I can't remember the writer. I'm terrible at remembering when it's important, you know, at the moment when it's important to remember. I'll remember on the train home.
We can put it in the notes.
Yes. But that when you're taking out punctuation and, you know, and then you find yourself putting back in the punctuation that you've taken out, that's kind of probably when it's
I read Chris Power writing about maybe putting commas in and then removing them again and knowing that he's probably done.
Yeah.
If he's done that a few times.
Well, then it's Chris Power. I'm happy
Let's
Chris
credit
Power
Chris Power.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. You can fiddle with a story to a point, and then if you find yourself making the same decisions over and over, maybe eventually you realise they're right.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also people talk about drafts, don't they? And I always wonder, do they mean that they've literally got something they call draft one and then something? Because I never quite... I suppose what I was going to say is that maybe that's where, you know, I was saying about the kind of metaphor. I don't... It's the same draft, but it's changed shape.
It's constantly evolving as you're whittling and chipping away.
Yeah. And then I suppose, yes, at occasions I will print it off. And reading aloud, I think, is... I keep forgetting that one, both to do it and to say that's something that's helpful. I find reading aloud really helpful. I find the workshop really helpful. And I find sticking it in a drawer, proverbial drawer for or whatever, for at least a week and looking at it again, really helpful. More so than I thought, you know.
It's magical, isn't it?
Yeah. And you just see things. I think being critical of your own writing is really hard, and that it does give you sufficient distance to be able to do that. Yeah.
I always feel like I'm in a good place if I can kind of enjoy crossing things out.
Yes. Like, no, I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's a relief because you can see afresh that, oh, that doesn't work. Yeah. And because you can't remember the moment that you wrote it anymore, it's less connected. So you can just put a pen through it.
Yeah.
And it's lovely.
Yeah. You can, again, I suppose it's that attachment thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Sort of those buttons just, again.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
I've only got a couple of questions left. Are you working on something fresh? Or are you resting your brain?
Well, I feel I should be working on something fresh. And I'm at the moment, I'm at the, what is it? I've put it, gathering material. No, but I'm mulling things. Mm-hmm. I'm mulling things. And I can't... I would like to... I mean, I love writing short stories. I really do like writing short stories. As a writer, and I'm late to writing in this way, and new to writing, if you like, I suppose exploring something longer might be something. I've just always thought I haven't got a novel in me. I've got lots of thoughts and moments and things that I can kind of, you know, smaller pieces of, not necessarily smaller in the sense of impact or anything. But anyway, so I would like to get back to another project, and whether, I suppose I don't know whether I think if I was going to write something longer, I wouldn't be able to write it in the way that I perceive as people write novels. It would have to be written in short, shorter pieces. And I did actually for my MA dissertation do quite a lot of reading around people who'd mainly sort of mainly women in the kind of mid 20th century that had written novels, but had sort
in
of
chunks,
small, yeah, and so. It's all there to explore. And I've also got the House of Bernarda Alba in my mind. And I think there's something about the mother and the sisters and that claustrophobic relationship that intrigues me. Not like, I mean, it's I saw the play actually at the Theatre Cervantes last week, and there was a matinee, so it was full of school kids. And I think the school kids, there was this boy who came out and just went, "Man, that was weird."
That was a great review.
Yes. But he obviously meant in a good way.
Yeah.
He obviously sort of, and they were all talking about it. It was really, really, really well performed. But so not that story, but just something. I wanted to kind of mull that a bit and think about. Gosh, I haven't said that to anybody.
Well, thanks for sharing.
Yes. Yeah, so I suppose I kind of mean, I don't know if it sounds... Anyway, no, stop it. that's what I'm doing, if I'm honest, or thinking about.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Something may come of it, something may not. It doesn't matter. It won't go to waste.
No,
yeah.
It could be a story. I mean, I think a novel is a huge commitment. There's no hurry to commit, is there?
No.
You have to get into it.
No.
Yeah,
no.
You can just experiment a bit.
Yeah,
indeed.
Yeah, and I think there's something as well about me. I've been learning Spanish on and off since I was a student, but I've sort of been trying to sort of do it a bit more seriously because we're hoping to spend a bit more time in Spain if we can.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something about learning to say things about me in Spanish that makes you, the language makes you think about what you're saying.
Yeah.
And one of the things about writing I suppose one is me cuesta, it costs me, it's a challenge, it's a challenge. I mean, a good challenge, an enjoyable challenge, but nonetheless a challenge. And the other thing is, and of course I can't remember how to say this now, but it gives me pleasure, it gives me pleasure. So so whatever the project is, I think it's a very, very productive use of my time.
Yeah. It's important you get pleasure out of it because it is difficult, isn't it? Writing doesn't get easier.
It gives me pleasure to finish something about
yeah.
as well.
yeah and to be engaged with something
and for it to be received, for it to be read, and for people to appreciate it and see things in it that you didn't see or that you did, it's just really, really, really rewarding.
I agree.
And
so the final question, which we ask all of our podcast guests, is just what are you reading at the moment? And are there any writers or particular books that you always return to?
My sister-in-law, Sarah, bought me the Persephone book of short stories, which is stories written by, I wasn't particularly aware of it, the stories written by women through the 20th century at different times. And there's a little sort of blurb about the writer. It includes people that I've heard of, like Catherine Mansfield. And there's a sort of little story in there called The Black Cap, which is sort of, quite witty and short. I've only sort of read a handful, and it's a hardback, so I don't take it on the tube or the train with me. But that's really interesting, both from the point of view of the history of women writers writing short stories, because the little blurb is engaging. I always find those things engaging. And the stories are, the ones that I've read so far are really, really good. And it's really interesting as to what was focused on then and how mm-hmm. it was put. And the first story I read was setting in a newspaper office in Chicago, and you just feel like you're in a newspaper. Wow. So I mean, it's just all those. So I've enjoyed that. And then I came across a number from what was the best Australian writing from a couple of years ago, because I don't think they do it anymore. And there's a writer called Josephine Rowe, who's a young writer, R-O-W-E, and she has published a collection of short stories called Here Until August, which I loved. And she's just published a novel, so that's on my list. And I know that it's going to be kind of Australian family drama. I think it's set in Victoria. People do read books again, don't they? And I've gone back to books to read a bit, but I've not read it. In fact, what I did recently was that I went back to the first book that ever really grabbed me, and I mean, it was a set book at school, was Laurie Lee's As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning. And I keep saying that to people, oh, yeah, you know, blah, blah. And I thought, you know what, I haven't actually looked at it for ages. So I did look at it a couple of months ago now. And actually, it's brilliant. And I can see, and I don't know what I made of it then, but I obviously thought it was great. But I hope I appreciated the metaphor in that. But the images just loom off the page. You know, you can see London, you can see Salisbury, a spire in the grass. So I really, really like, and also Dylan Thomas, I suppose being Welsh, I have to sort of mention Dylan Thomas, but he actually, I remember sort of approaching him a bit like, but actually he's really good.
Yeah, he's all right.
he's really, really good. And there's a story called The Incredible Little... See, I can't remember the name, but anyway, it's I remember being really, really saddened by it when I read it, because it's about the very kind of ordinary cruelty of children, I think, and how these group of boys treat another boy. And when I read it again, I actually saw that some of the boys are really kind, so it's not as bad as I thought when I first read it. But anyway, again, I think writing that compels. And and also, I do sometimes, if I'm writing a short story and I think I'm going a bit too flat, I sometimes just pick up somebody I really like or have read recently, like Irenison Okeji, maybe, or Ellie Williams, or Sarah Baum, again, because I know she's not short stories per se, but and read a bit just to kind of get
sort of ignite,
my writing muscles kind of oiled a bit by something that's different, but... Does that answer the question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very well. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Absolute pleasure. I think, we've come to the end of all of my notes. I really appreciate you coming up here to talk to us.
I appreciate being invited. Really.
Pleasure.
Yeah. No, it's been very, very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the BOB podcast. Please remember to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch on social media via @BrickLaneBooks or email us at inquiries@BrickLaneBookshop.org.
This podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. It was produced and edited by Kate Ellis and Peter J. Coles, and music was by Andrew Everett. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at BrickLaneBookshop.org or search Brick Lane Bookshop wherever you find podcasts.